Hey everyone, it's me, your good friend Sarah Century, and I am here to give you a heads up that this week's episode, we have our very first guest sound editor with Nathaniel Hubbard of the Tighten Up the Defense podcast. Tighten Up the Defense is great if you like the Defenders or the Teen Titans, or you would like to like them, or you don't really like them, but you want to hear about them, which is sometimes I'm in all three groups. So I enjoy it a lot. You should check it out. I've guested on the podcast many times, so you can use that as an entryway. That's okay. Everybody needs an entryway. So yeah, check it out. And thanks a lot to Nathaniel Hubbard for jumping in and doing the sound editing while Kate Warner is off and enjoying working overtime at her day job. Sorry, Kate. Everybody, welcome to another edition of Bitches on Comics. I'm happy to be here, and I'm happy that our guest is here as well. I'm Sarah Century, but I'm going to go ahead and ask our esteemed guests to introduce themselves, please. Hello.
Hello. This is Heather Einhorn, co-founder and CEO of EEP Universe.
Yeah. So
that's the intro.
There you have it. If somebody hasn't heard of EEP as of yet, then how would you describe it?
So EEP is a creative house. We produce platform agnostic intellectual property that's focused on female forward and inclusive characters. So, you know, I know that's like a lot of words. So basically what it means is like we produce awesome stories. These are the stories that and the characters that I wanted to see growing up. So it's like badass ladies doing badass things. It's like, I guess the simplest way to describe what we do.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of genre hopping, right? Because there are so far podcasts in mostly the sci-fi vein, I guess. Is that something that's very intentional? Were you setting out immediately just to be like, I am doing genre fiction and that's like what we're here for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we play in all different categories, but you know, I come from DC Comics, Legendary Pictures, so genre, sci-fi, horror, fantasy, that's where we live, that's where we love to live. And luckily for us, there's so many amazing stories that haven't been told with female inclusive characters in that space. So we really feel like it's just like our little playground where we can jump in and do cool stuff.
Yeah, that's something that comes up a lot with me because I always kind of have to remember that whenever I was reading comics to begin with, it was the 90s. And then up until like 2015, it was still a rarity for women to be popping up, right? On like credits list of comic books. Not to dismiss like all of the people who are in those spaces and working in those spaces. But I remember kind of looking back around like New 52 era, and I was like, is Gail Simone like the only woman that was writing for DC like at that time? And it's like literally like 2012, right? I always have to kind of put it in perspective because I feel that over the last few years, there's been such an explosion of incredible stories. A lot of, you know, women, queer people, trans people doing a lot of fascinating, interesting, kind of groundbreaking work. And people are actually hearing about it, I think, a little bit more than I did whenever I was a kid, right? So it's like, it's almost something where I have to remind myself that this is all kind of new and can easily go away, right? So we like kind of have to keep it going is what I think. But yeah, what do you think about that?
Oh, 100%. I mean, we look at the landscape now and we founded EEP in 2017. And exactly what you're saying, like the increase in characters and creators in this space is because everyone is continuing to move it forward. But same thing, when I was at DC Comics, not only was it like rare to have like multiple women in the room at the same time, but the biggest thing, and one of the things that we've tried to overcome here at EEP is that the female characters that were introduced were ultimately just derivative of male characters, right? So when there would be a female character, and I hate to hate on specific characters, you know, because they're all amazing. But like you get the, you know, the She-Hulks of the world, and we love She-Hulk, and that's awesome. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, She-Hulk is literally Hulk with, it's like Girl Hulk, right? Or like, you know, Spider-Girl or Batgirl even. And these are all characters that I personally love. But can we get like our own? Like, like that was sort of, that was sort of the initial premise of EEP was like, yeah, we know the audience is going to be out there, but let's create these absolutely like original characters, which still there's more, way more work to be done to your point. Because at any moment, I always feel like the other shoe can drop and we can go back to, like recently it was announced that Jennifer Garner was going to be back as Elektra in like the Deadpool 3 movie, right? And originally, I don't know if everyone sort of remembers, but Elektra used to be the case study that people would cite to say, well, female action adventure doesn't work. Just look at Elektra.
Right.
So we get one, but meanwhile, like there's so many like male-driven action genre sci-fi things that just come out and flop, but women get one. And then it's like, well, Elektra's dead, you know? So
yeah, anyway, I mean, the Wonder Woman movie just happened, you know, like it's one of those things. Or, you know, you're hearing always about how dismissive people are towards like the Wonder Woman line. I think I've heard that a lot is, you know, obviously there's been so many great creators. I think that Wonder Woman just had a completely untouchable, pretty much like 5 or 6 year run. Like there was just like great creator after great creator happening. And it just seemed like one run led so well into the next. And it seems like this should be kind of a normal thing for a monthly book that's been going since like the 40s. But it's so kind of interesting because it's like, no, you don't understand being a Wonder Woman fan, right? Because there's times where people write Wonder Woman where it seems like they hate her. And you're just like, that's so bizarre. And I think that just recently we have a Wonder Woman movie. And that to me is just wild because she's always been considered one of the three big DC names, right? Mm-hmm. And it's just like, of course, we had to have like 25 Batman movies and, you know, all of these takes on Superman and they get all of these animated spinoffs and everything. And it just takes so long for Wonder Woman to get like a movie. And it's
like, we have to wait that long. Yeah, for every character. You know, because Wonder Woman's like the one of the oldest DC comics.
Yeah.
So we have to wait literally like 50 years.
She's famous. She's world famous. She is widely recognizable across the planet, you know, and it just took a really long time. And then, I don't know, like the Wonder Woman, I think more than any other main character that's been going that long, her book is really uneven. You know, you read from the beginning to now and it's uneven. Like there's so many greats and then there's so many kind of bummer town moments. But that kind of is what I was going to say about She-Hulk, Spider-Woman. You brought them up and it's like, yeah, now both of those characters have very distinctive personalities, but it took like whole original series with them for those personalities to come out, right?
Years and years and years.
Yeah,
to
that
even
first
get
She-Hulk
to.
Series is like all that, right? It's just like, I'm doing Hulk stuff because nobody really took the time to figure out what my character was going to be. And then at the very end of the series, she's like, actually, I think I kind of like being a Hulk. And that's like, bam, there's her personality. Now we know who she is. Like, she's different from Bruce because she likes being Hulk. But it just took like so long to get to that place. So I always think about that.
Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely.
Like, but to your point, you know, it's like, as much as that is a challenge and an ongoing challenge and ongoing worry, that just kind of does inspire you more to be like, okay, well, I'm just going to keep it going.
Well, yeah, I mean, and to your point earlier, it's like the work is certainly not done, right? Because you have these, what we now think of iconic characters that literally, whereas the male versions of those characters right off the bat have personalities and coherent backstories, and the you know, you have the female characters that are just like, I'm the lady of that, right?
Yeah.
And so that's not, you know, a fully fledged character that would be compelling and just basically have their own story and their own vibe. It's really funny because I'm obviously a Barbie and Ken on the brain right now in the opposite vein, where Ken was basically just the accessory to Barbie, right? And it's a lot of these, you know, female derivative characters feel like accessories. And then when finally you get like a standalone character like Wonder Woman. And I could talk about Wonder Woman for like an entire separate podcast.
Same here.
You know,
that's like, it.
Right? Like that's like, there's like a whole journey, you know, and then it takes us literally like 50 years or whatever to get the movie. But ultimately, I think one of the reasons why the character is so uneven throughout the years and even throughout the, I mean, I know it won't be controversial to say that Wonder Woman 84 you know, left a little bit on the table for me, you know, a little bit of a letdown there. And I think, you know, one of the reasons, and this circles back to what we do at EEP, is that inherently the creation of the character at its base level, as you know, has like, there's a lot of like problematic stuff that is a part of Wonder Woman's inherent character creation. And so, you know, if the only characters that are getting greenlit were literally created 50 years ago by men with various issues underlying them, or they're derivative of male characters, it certainly leaves an opening for like fresh female characters that don't have that baggage. And so, yeah, I just, everything that we've done at EEP supports that thesis. That was the original thesis of EEP. And I think we've been supported in some of the successes we've had, which is great.
Yeah, I was actually going to say that it's interesting you bring up Wonder Woman 84, because not to offer like a stark comparison, but I was going to say that a lot of the nostalgia, I think, of that film fell flat for a lot of people. But what I've enjoyed recently about EEP has been that it is like very boldly nostalgic in a way, right? Because there's like kind of these like bright popping colors and like, you know, the fonts and everything, they harken back to a time, right? But then at the same time, it feels very modern. And I think that that's kind of like when you're doing nostalgia stuff, which like a lot of people are doing, and I'm not going to say that EEP is nostalgia like that. I don't think that that would really hold up, just that there are nostalgic elements, I guess. And I was going to say too, that it's kind of interesting because the way that you pull off nostalgia, right, is by tying it to the current moment. And I think that that's something that Barbie is doing really successfully. So I wanted to ask if you had any thoughts on that, because, you know, it's just such an interesting thing. A lot of times people view nostalgia in the market as being kind of like the bad guy or something, or like the elephant in the room nobody wants to talk about. It can be kind of great though, right?
Like, oh, absolutely. I mean, I think nostalgia is the emotional secret sauce that when placed into an original concept, when you make the like stew of what comprises an original concept, I think anybody that claims that nostalgia is not inherently included in their concept is not living in reality, right? Because we've all consumed media throughout our entire lives. Like one of our podcasts is Daughters of DC, and we wrote the main character, James Parker, as a like badass secret vigilante hacker situation, right? And so how could I deny that Oracle is not somehow intertwined? Like, I've consumed that content. I love that character. Like, how could I say that like my love of that character and of that girl in general doesn't inform my like badass lady hacker character, you know? Like, so yeah, I think nostalgia mixed with fresh, you know, and I think there are shows that have done this very, very well. Like Stranger Things is the first thing that comes to mind in terms of, you know, mass media that we could all immediately recognize can pluck the elements of nostalgia while layering on a fresh story. And yeah, I mean, our other podcast, which is also a book series, Lethal Lit, I mean, like, I'm a big fan of Sherlock Holmes and detective stories, and also of the Scream franchise, you know? So
right. How
can we, the wink and the nod that Scream gives, the original OG Scream, you know, how can we not deny that that horror, that genre of horror is not a part of horror concepts that we see today?
I mean, Scream is ridiculous, right? Because, I mean, I just got finished writing, I'm doing a Scream zine right now, because
love.
I had a piece that it didn't go anywhere. Basically, there was editorial stuff and everything that is 2023, basically. So I wrote this big old piece, and then it turned out it didn't go anywhere. And I was like, I cannot let this go. I just got finished watching the entire franchise, including the TV series, all over again.
Oh,
and so I was like, I have to do something with this. So I'm doing a zine about it right now that I've been pulling together. I think I'll end up announcing it very soon. But yeah, it's basically that. I was like looking back over it, and I was like, it's so wild how it's such a derivative nostalgic movie, but it's in and of itself, there was never anything like that movie. Like, that movie is just like truly brilliant. They were using, you know, that great script, that great director who we all know and love, and it's just like, something about it just clicks just so well, because I watched it as a teenager and I was kind of just like, oh, I wonder if this holds up. And then, you know, kind of went back into it and it's like, yeah, it does. Like, this is a good movie. And like the sequels are honestly really good too, you know, like it kind of, if you watch them all in a row, like I did, you start to be kind of like, okay, all right.
It's getting a little camp.
I get it, but it's really good. I mean, they're all really good and worth watching multiple times, I think. And they have different things to say. I think that something that they do really smart is every single time they're tying it to something. For instance, not to spoil a movie that's been out for actually kind of a while now, but the most recent Scream was commenting on nostalgia, right? And like kind of how bad that could be. And then like the last one, you know, it's like they keep kind of changing up the theme, and it's always something that is like very current. Like people who only want their franchise to do the same thing again and again or something like that. Like that's been the last couple movies, which is totally different than just the nerds who watch too many horror films in like 1995 or whatever, right? But totally. It still keeps with the theme, you know? It's just like, I'm glad to hear that that's been an influence, because I've just been thinking about that franchise a lot, like while also listening to EEP podcasts. So I think I'm just maybe on like a vibe right now with like all of this.
Well, who knows if it's, you know, the cart and the horse, but I mean, if you're if you've been listening to the EEP stuff and you're thinking about Scream, then you're like in my brain, right? Because these are because this is 100%. I mean, and these are, I think that, you know, even things like Indiana Jones, which even at the time when it came out was nostalgic for the action heroes of the 1940s when it came out in the 80s, right? And I think that was a fresh take, like nostalgia mixed with something fresh at the time. And obviously, you know, as things move through the years, as we've seen with the recent Indiana Jones, things might necessarily not hold up for that period of time. But horror, and I think the way Scream introduced, it's one part nostalgia, one part winking at the audience, and one part media commentary. And, you know, in particular for Lethal Lit, like that was the same headspace we were in when we were creating and producing that one. You know, and with that one, it's the lit killer and all of the murders are staged after scenes from classic literature. And, you know, you have Tig Torres, who's the detective who just loves books, and she like knows books so well that only she can crack the case, you know, which is, you know, not only teen detective, but also horror, where you have, you know, I mean, I don't need to tell you, it's the idea of the final girl and what gives her the superpower, the ability to basically overcome, you know, Freddy Krueger, or, you know, take your pick of whichever villain in any of these horror movies. But there's something sort of like super about that final girl that gives her the ability to sort of escape the killer and basically solve the case, right? Because the police are always bumbling, you know, whether it's Ned Campbell or Jamie Lee Curtis, you know.
Oh, yeah. They're useless in the Scream franchise, right? Like, again and again, like the cops are just sitting in their car and they get killed like really fast. And even comment like, oh, no, I think we're going to die. The cops always die in these movies.
Oh, man. I mean, that's, you know, YA in general, if you're doing YA correctly, right? I always feel like the adults are idiots. Yep. And the kids are the smartest people in the room. And if somebody pitches us a YA concept, and we're creating a YA concept where the adults get to come in and ultimately save the day, that to me is totally missing the mark. And I think a lot of the best horror movies, you know, sometimes we don't think of horror as necessarily being YA, but it is, because ultimately the police are boneheads, you know, and the teachers and all the adults ultimately get murdered and the kids always somehow save the day.
Right. So, well, and also, isn't it that like in the 80s, I grew up in the 80s, like I was born in 1983. So it's basically just like, you know, every children's movie from that era, like were all horror movies for sure. Like Labyrinth is definitely a horror movie.
Horrifying. Like, horrifying. I can't watch Labyrinth. It's to me, Labyrinth is scarier than Scream.
It's really scary. I mean, it's terrifying. The scene where he's like pulling her through that, like the bubbles or whatever, like that is like, I'll never get over it. But, you know, Return to Oz, Watership Down, you know, so just like the list goes on. Everything that I watched as a kid, I used to love the Japanese cartoon Unico, and Unico is so messed up. Like, they're all horror, and it's just like, it's an unambiguously like a horror movie, right? So I think, you know, that might be aimed for slightly younger, but I think it's the same with YA. There's so much horror in YA.
I mean, I grew up in the 80s as well. And I can tell you that the stuff that we were allowed to consume, which is truly like the Brave Little Toaster. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
Just truly heartbreaking. Could not, just horrifying. Like, oh, my God. Like, what? Like, this is absolutely, there was this scene. I think I'm traumatized by it, where the whole gang winds up at a junkyard.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. I knew you were going to say this scene. I knew it.
Yeah. And the cars are singing a little song about who are. You know, like I was in getting the Indy 500. I was this. I was that. And then literally you watch the car get smashed into a cube. Like they're murdering these cars right in front of it. Like they give the car a personality for 30 seconds and then literally murder it in front of the children. And then the toaster is about to go down the conveyor belt or whatever it is. But
they make that movie and like think that we weren't going to grow up to be skeptical of crass consumerism?
You can't get away with that, you know, nowadays, because that would be flagged as being something it should have been flagged, because clearly I'm still thinking about it, right? But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what was horror, what is horror? I think that there's a whole other, you know, podcast there. But I think of everything that we do as genre. But like I said, like, it's like, you know, superpowers don't necessarily have to be like, oh, I fell into a vat of toxic waste, or I have a lasso of truth, you know, which sort of feels dated at this point. Like Jamie Lee Curtis freaking like surviving every single one of those Halloween movies. Like that's her superpower. Like she's a survivor. Like there you go. Like she clearly has some magic to her that she can survive, or, you know, even Neve Campbell or whatever. But yeah, no, I certainly think horror, you know, I'll take that back, because, you know, I've recently, since I just had a baby, I've been rewatching some of the older Disney stuff as well. And there's the first thing they do is kill off all the parents. Right. So, I mean, ton of horror in the Disney stuff as well. So what are you going to do? It's a little bit, it's everywhere.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's it. It's like, of course, watching Bambi, like, absolutely wrecked me as a kid, like, in a way that I think I'm probably never going to recover from, since I'm, like, 40 and I'm still really concerned, you know? I mean, I have, like, 7 pets in my house right now. So clearly, like, it taught me to have care, I guess. Because it's like, you know, I mean, the hunters are really the villains in that. And I'm vegan, but I don't necessarily think that hunters are villains, right? I'm just like, I'm literally just saying ways that Bambi changed my life. Because it's just like, oh yeah, now I'm vegan. But, you know, I am just always kind of just amazed at how kind of devastating it was. Of course, Bambi, whenever it first came out, bombed, right? Because everybody was like, this is depressing. Why are you showing this to children? But by the 80s, everything had come back around. So it was okay for me to watch it. And so I don't know. It's interesting. It became a classic after a while. But it's interesting that that movie almost like bankrupted Disney. Like Disney might not exist now because of Bambi almost.
Because that's just bad decision making. It's the same thing as Brave Little Toaster. I mean, you're literally like murdering animals in front of children. It's worse than cars, actually, because animals are living beings. I mean, some people love their cars, but like animals are living beings. But even the later Disney stuff, I would say, you know, and it's different because, you know, there's classic horror, there's horror that, you know, where there's a killer chasing the final girl, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's what we would sort of think of as more classic. But I was actually saying to my husband, Adam, recently, because we were watching a bunch of the classic Disney movies, that some of the things that happen, you know, in Beauty and the Beast or even The Little Mermaid, those are horrific, like traumatic events.
Yeah.
Mostly happening to the female characters, you know, like, so it's like, hey, Belle, either we're going to lock your father up forever, or you have to like be a prisoner in this castle. And then Belle like escapes the castle and comes back to town. And it's just literally, it's trauma after trauma after trauma, yeah. mostly on these female characters. And it's because obviously all the Disney stuff is based on the classic fairy tales, which were, you know, written, again, same issue, written by men, not even 50 years ago, hundreds of years ago or whatever, you know, the Grimm fairy tales. And I was like, there's something really bonkers about all of this. You know, poor Ariel, she doesn't even have any lines in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
She got 3 lines. Just and she has to convince Eric to fall in love with her without speaking. Like, I don't know. It's feeling a little questionable. I hate to hate on Disney, but it's feeling a little questionable.
And they kind of cleaned it up from the original, too, which is kind of hilarious, because it's like, this is questionable. And it's like, oh my God, you read the original fairy tale and you're just like, this is worse.
Oh yes. The OG, right. The Disney versions that are problematic in their own ways are the cleaned up versions of the original versions. You're totally right.
Yeah, which You're are totally already right. the cleaned up versions of some folktale, right? So it's mm-hmm. just like, oh man. So yeah, I'm going to say kids have been consuming really messed up media for a very long time. Sometimes I think it's a little questionable. Sometimes I think it simply made me who I am today. And so, you know, how questionable can I find it in a way? Some critical thinking skills have come from this. You know, there's times where it's like they're warning you against trusting total strangers sometimes, which can be a good thing when you're a kid like me who just wanted to be everybody's bud or whatever. But oh, totally. Yeah, it's just always kind of interesting, right? All right, this is all great. I want it now. Come back for the Disney podcast. Like, come back for the Wonder Woman podcast. We have some side projects now to work on. But right. I wanted to talk about the timeline for EEP, because you said that it started in 2017. I think I only discovered EEP maybe about a year ago. So I don't think I quite have the timeline. So where did you all start and how did the flow go? Like, how are you from 2017 to today? Kind of what... This is a hard one probably to sum up and like, again, you know, like, oh, how do I sum up like the last like 6 years whenever there's been like 400 world disasters as well, you know? How have things been?
Right. Don't worry. The media doesn't need to traumatize the next generation of children. They're going to be traumatized all on their own, right?
Right.
Oh my God. No, I'll try to summarize it as quickly as I can. It's a long and windy journey. I mean, originally, I'll go back even a little further to just sort of set it up a little bit more. Like, I worked for DC Comics and then moved out to LA for a little while to work for Legendary Pictures. Between, you know, Legendary and DC, obviously, I worked on Batman, you know, for probably upwards of 10 years. I was lucky enough to be at Legendary during the Dark Knight Rises era, during Pacific Rim era, during Godzilla era. So got to work on some really, really iconic franchises. But again, like circling back to the problem that EEP was founded to solve was, you know, these are, again, like, I love them. These are genre classics, but it's very dude driven, very, you know, straight white male. And, you know, these were not, I mean, actually tying in very nicely to what we're talking about, these were not the characters that I saw growing up, the characters that I would have loved the next generation to experience, right? Because we can have female heroes, even female heroes in horror projects, but remove the like problematic misogyny that we see in a lot of the stuff we grew up with, right?
Right.
So EEP was founded with the premise that, hey, like, there is a market, right? And this was, again, even a couple of years ago, I was still fighting, you know, in the room. It's right. less of a fight today, which is great. Like, we're doing what we set out to do. But it was founded just based on the idea that there is an actual market, like a business. There's a business that could surround these characters. But for various reasons, it's just been the same legacy characters over and over again with basically the same stories, you know, regurgitated. So we founded EEP with that premise. And it's kind of crazy. So we were going to be platform agnostic. I came from comics, but then worked in movies, and Legendary launched Legendary TV. And then we launched Legendary Comics. I was a part of the launch there as well. So I really had a chance, basically through the Batman lens, to understand the way a character, a piece of IP, when constructed correctly, can really travel across platforms. So Batman could be a comic, Batman could be a live action TV show, Batman could be an animated TV show, Batman could be a movie. And also, if constructed correctly, and stop me if this is getting a little too in the weeds, but, you know, when constructed correctly, an IP can also be aged up and down, you know. So really, mm-hmm. you know, you can have Brave and the Bold, you can have, you know, Chris Nolan Batman, you can have emo Robert Pattinson Batman, you know, there's so many different versions of that character, because the character is what we call stretchy and can sort of travel between the different avenues and different platforms. So these right. were the types of IPs that we were looking to create. I'd known for a while that I wanted to go out and sort of like not be a part, after working for basically DC and Warner Brothers and Legendary for a good while, we'll say, a hot second. I knew I wanted to go out and be a little bit more entrepreneurial and sort of do my own thing and take a shot at it, you know? So at least if it didn't work or whatever, like I wouldn't be sitting in the corporate office being like, I woulda, coulda, shoulda, you know, life's too short. Mm-hmm. I'm young. Let's go for it. And so I was riding the F train because I was living in Brooklyn at the time after I founded EEP. And I started getting into podcasts. And so we just founded the company. We were sort of figuring out our direction and all that good stuff and noodling around, circling around different ideas. And I got really into podcasts because the F train just never showed up. So it was really interesting to me because podcasts was this, it was like what's old is new again. And then I started circling back to like the radio plays, the Superman Radio Hour, War of the Worlds, and all these sort of genre podcasts. And it was like, oh my gosh. And you know, that whole, everything I just said about Batman, I never included audio in that wasn't in it. It was comics, TV, film, animated, you know, but where was audio? And audio was sitting here the whole time, right? So, you know, got a meeting with iHeart. And this is in 2018. They were just sort of dipping their podcasts were just becoming, it was like, oh my God, podcast. But all the podcasts coming out were nonfiction. And so I went to iHeart and I said, listen, I have this idea for a podcast about a teen detective who has a podcast and it's called Lethal Lit. And I was like, I'll never forget. I was so nervous to do the pitch, you know, got the whole pitch, did the pitch. And it's like, you know, when you're like, it's like the magic of like those days where it's like, ooh, like sprinkle glitters. And they just absolutely loved it. And it totally made sense because it was a podcast in the vein of, because Serial was very popular at the time, which then circles back to Scream, right? Because it's the idea of media commentary infused with horror. And then obviously putting our coat of paint on it means it's going to be like badass female YA vibes. So, you know, all those things mixed together, they loved it. They pretty much bought it in the room, which was just the best day ever. Lethal Lit came out. It was the first YA fiction podcast like ever from iHeart. So that was a huge accomplishment. And it actually did really, really well. We were number 4 with Lethal Lit on the overall charts, not the fiction charts, the like overall charts. It was like Lethal Lit and then like NPR, you know, so it was really, really exciting. And then from there, that's when the ball starts rolling down the hill because you realize that it's like, hey, we have something here because there is an audience. That's our case study of, hey, it's not just talk. Like, here's a character, here's a concept, it's fully executed. And I'll never forget it because we recorded Lethal Lit. It's different. And again, there could be a whole other podcast just about the podcast fiction production and how that differs from nonfiction production. But it was, you know, we flew in the director from LA, we had a table read with the cast and, you know, all that good stuff. And literally we recorded Lethal Lit in a heat wave in New York. The air conditioning broke in the recording studio. It was like I can't even tell you. I went to Home Depot and bought a fan just and had it just on my face in the producer room because it was just so crazy. But yeah, just an amazing experience. We work with amazing actors, voice actors, directors, writers. We use a writer's room approach for all of our podcasts. So typically we come up with the concept in-house, but then we invite, it's very similar to comics, actually. We create the characters, we create the bones of the IP, and then we invite other writers to come and join us and write different episodes of whichever the podcast is. But yeah, Lethal Lit started it. And from there, we did an entire slate of fiction podcasts. Lethal Lit, then See You in Your Nightmares. So we put full horror on that. Daughters of EC, our political thriller, Nikki Fix, time travel. And up next is Bump Set Juliet, which is our first romance, but we call it like romance action because it's a sports drama because it's, and it's actually an LGBTQ sports drama with two rival girls volleyball teams, you know, loosely based on Romeo and Juliet. And yeah, we just started producing podcasts. And then at the same time, obviously pursuing, you know, graphic novels and web comics because we've, and stop me if this is getting a little too long.
You're doing exactly what I wanted you to do because I was like, listen, I need like a baseline, right? Like this makes sense because I have mine. I like have been able to like pick and choose over the last year, you know, but you know, this is great. So please continue.
Okay, you just stop me anytime. While we were doing all the podcasts, you know, and again, just remaining platform agnostic and really wanting to just continue to produce IP in different medias, we signed the first ever fiction graphic novel deal with MIT. We had this idea, it was called the Curie Society. It's a secret society of female scientists. It's basically like Mission Impossible with STEM. And, you know, we brought that idea around and we got introduced to MIT Press. And we thought, they're never going to make this because Mary Curie didn't actually start a secret society. You know, we like made this up and they were like, no, we love it. And so, so we did the Carey Society with MIT, and we also have we continued with our graphic novels, and we have a deal with Little Brown. So coming up is the Carey Society. The first volume came out and did very, very well. And the next volume, volume two, is actually coming out in spring of 2024. So that's incredibly exciting. And there's a third volume coming up right after that. So there's going to be three volumes now of the Carey Society. And we're obviously adapting it. There's not too much I could talk about on that front right now, but there's the Carey Society will continue on past graphic novels for sure. The same thing with Lethal Lit, actually. And then with Little Brown, the first book out of our deal with Little Brown is called Absolute Zeros, which is like a Bad News Bears at space camp. Like really cute, really fun situation, also coming out spring of next year. And there'll be volume two of Absolute Zeros as well. And we have a bunch of other books coming out with Little Brown as well. And then, yeah, in the meantime, we also got into animation because,
yes,
you know, because who needs
you did not have enough going on. And so,
because it's the character, we build out these IPs and then we say, well, where would this best like live, you know, and we just love to play in different platforms. And so we had this idea for like a K-pop star who basically was trapped in an interdimensional music prison. And as I say the log line out loud now, it sounds just as awesome as when we first created this character, and her name is Hexel. And Hexel, she's a webtoon, and she has animated music videos. You can check her out. It's free Hexel. And Hexel also, we actually produced several original K-pop songs to go along with this IP. So if you go to Spotify and check out Free Hexel, she's got over 500,000 streams on her latest K-pop album. So these are all the things that we do. We just, you know, have fun and do crazy stuff. So I guess that's really what EEP is about, to be honest.
Yeah, I was thinking about this because it's something like one of the things that we do at Bitches on Comics is we have a publishing company, and we started this by doing PDFs, right, of these anthologies. We were doing like a story a day thing every Pride. And so we made these like massive PDF collections that you can still buy just for the listeners, right? But it's like they're on sale at the decodedpride.com website. But after that, like we were kind of like, oh, well, we can't just keep doing this because we did it 3 years in a row. So we all just started to be like, what else are we going to do? Right. And so we started kind of adapting it to audio because, like, I also, you know, love the old radio plays and stuff like that. And I listen to tons and tons and tons of podcasts, like just kind of a weird amount of podcasts, actually. Like, it's too many faves. I have too many faves when it comes to podcasts. But yeah, I've been like kind of thinking about it a lot lately because now obviously our publishing company is still going, but like the idea of kind of branching out to different things. And then I'm starting a production company that does video production. And so I've been thinking a lot about kind of multimedia, I guess, right? And yeah, how that is. And yeah, this is like, is my question for you is basically just, you know, you just listed more things than we are doing, actually, which is wild because usually we're like, wow, we're doing way too many things. And then it's kind of inspirational to hear that you're doing actually a few different things because we haven't gotten into web comics, right? You know, there's a few things and so, yeah, or animation, right? So yep, we're not there. But I think that that's just something that's very interesting because, and it's like this, it's almost difficult to exactly word this because I just kind of want to maybe say from one publisher to another or something, like, how do you think that being multimedia is, I guess, important? How do you think that it fuels the creativity behind the scenes? Because I think it does. Like, I think the idea of keeping things kind of open-ended for what you might want to do. A lot of people tell you to find one thing and to just stick with it. But I think that the trick to that is to actually do a lot of different things, but to do it in a way where your brand or whatever, like who you are and what your values are, is kind of the same across the board, right? Mm-hmm. So basically, like, question mark, do you think that's correct?
Well, there's two schools of thought on this, right? And certainly there are people who are amazing authors, right? And they'll write 20 books and all of the books are great and they write books, right? So awesome. Like, cool. Good for them. Like, I root for them. Like, be passionate about something, go out and execute it. And as long as the quality is high and you can, and you love what you do, right? Like, awesome, like, do that. That's not me. So And I think it sort of circles back to everyone's like, well, what's the secret sauce to juggling and doing all the different platforms? And I always say, well, the secret sauce is that I love the challenge of creating and producing in a new platform. So my enjoyment of that process, I think, is infused into the different IPs that we create. If I didn't love doing what we're doing and juggling all this, you have to sort of love the juggle, I guess, if that's the kind of person that you are. Because if you do, and again, now this is definitely my personal opinion, I think the best producers today are actually always looking at the next platform. And the through line is great storytelling, great characters, and just wanting to make awesome stuff. And the through line is not, I work in comics and we are making comics. I work in podcasts and we are making podcasts. I just never was about that box that you can only do one thing and just be good at that one thing. That's just the EEP sort of methodology. Is the through line is the characters, the stories, the IP, not the platform. But certainly there are, other people who go the other way. So I don't think there's necessarily a right or wrong answer on that. It's more just individual taste for the juggling versus the tunnel vision of the one platform. But yeah, I mean, to me, especially because we go after younger audiences, there's always a new platform, there's always a new thing. So the best producers, I think, are flexible, always looking to the future, with a nod to the past. I mean, fiction podcasts are the way we produce them. Yes. Is current characters, current stories. But obviously, Superman Radio Hour, War of the World, I mean, there's been radio plays. What's old is new, is always new again. So as we move to these future platforms, there's always pieces of the past. Circling back to our conversation about nostalgia as well, nostalgia isn't not just infused into the stories themselves, it's infused into the platforms of the future as well. So yeah, I mean, that's just, again, just totally caveat. That's my personal point of view on this. But I love the challenge of being ooh, what's this new thing? Here's an IP,
yes.
Not shoehorning it. One more caveat on this, not shoehorning it, because what happened with podcasts is that all of a sudden everyone's like, oh, podcast. And then you start to get these pitches that you can tell are just television shows that you want to make into, a backdoor television pilot instead of like Leaflet's one of my favorite examples, because it's a podcast about a podcaster. So obviously it makes sense as a podcast, right? A podcast about a group of skydivers, for instance, would make less sense because you can't see the skydiving. It's a visual, so that's, that's a ridiculous, ridiculous example. But
somebody could make it work too, right? And that's kind of the thing with podcasts, because you really are not necessarily limited. Because, I've mentioned a couple of times that I am obsessed with old radio. I've listened to all of the old horror, and I think that stuff is masterclass. If you want to learn how to tell a story with just dialogue, that is absolute masterclass stuff. I think that writers should pay a lot of attention to those old, because you've got Sorry, Wrong Number is maybe one of the most famous ones. Mm-hmm. There's just so many that I just can't even start mentioning them now, because then it'll be the 1940s horror podcast. But I just think that that's something where it's take the extra time and listen to this stuff, because it's a very unique style of storytelling. And it also makes it to where, you really can tell if somebody has a genuine love for the genre and or if they're TV pilot or whatever, mm-hmm. because it's just you recognize just the classic setups, the classic, tropes of it. But then the fact that a lot of times whenever people are I'm going to do a radio show that's like the old time radio shows, then what that means is that they're going to do a pastiche, right? And it's just as we've said a few times in this interview, it's the important thing about those, the reason that they work so well is that they worked exactly in their moment. So something like Sorry, Wrong Number, where it's this woman who is kind of alone in her apartment and she keeps hearing the threats that are coming through on her phone. And she knows somebody is going to come get her. Somebody is going to kill her. And she's trying to convince other people of this simply from her bedroom. And so the whole thing just happens in a single room and it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And the build of it is just incredible. So I think about that a lot, because it's just that stuff is like underrated masterclass, in my opinion. I just think that that's all stuff for people to pay attention to. So I'm glad that you brought it up, because it's stuff that is just so near and dear to my heart as well. But it's important because you're like, you want to make sure that it's something like, it has to be great storytelling. It has to be in love with whatever medium. You can choose whatever medium, but you really do have to be in love with whichever one you're choosing, because I think people can really tell if you're not, right?
Totally. I think the passion for whatever the creative piece is, regardless of platform, I think you can tell when a project, like, and it's especially true with the big budget films, I think you can tell when people just sort of gave up midway through and threw their hands in the air and said, listen, you want me to put this thing out? Here it is. You know, versus when people were super, yeah. like, you know, into the Spider-Verse, like super passionate about the story and the animation and the characters and that, and all that good stuff, versus something that's just like, listen, let's get this thing out, like 100%. And yeah, to your point, the concept should work totally with the platform that you can write a concept and then be like, I would like to make this into a podcast, but then you still have to take the next step and be like, sorry, wrong number. Great example of like, this is a great podcast, because there's that audio integration into it's phone calls, right? So same thing with Lethal Lid, it's a podcaster. So you have the audio component built into the show. So it makes sense as a podcast, as sort of like laboring to make the shoe fit, you know, like Hexel, it made sense for us to produce some original songs for that, because even though it was an animated IP, it was a music-driven concept, so it made sense to have a song or two to illustrate, like, what's type of music, to sort of fill in that blank for the listeners. Yeah, I really think that, especially with the pace with which platforms are changing, that, yeah, like, the best producers are flexible and having fun, and I think that the only ceiling is really if you're juggling too many things to the point where you start to sacrifice quality, and this is every producer or creator, myself included, right. You know, faces this question of how many people are on the team, how many projects am I juggling, am I doing too much? And every person's number is sort of different. You know, all those projects I listed are over the course of like 60, those are some highlights from the past 6 years, you know? So I would say like, right. Do all the things, but you don't necessarily need to do all the things at the exact same time.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh my God. That's a big thing, right? Because we're all always working with teams that are just a little too small, right? Not that we're not all giving it our best, but there's only so many people who can only dedicate so many hours, and there's only so much money to go around. And those limitations really can make you kind of, you know, just come up with, it's the mother of invention or whatever, right? It's like you can come up with incredible stuff. But it is very important to make sure that you kind of have a handle on things, because otherwise you're disappointing like a lot of people, right? So it's always something where it's like you kind of have to juggle that responsibility.
Hello there.
Oh, hi.
How are you doing today?
Well, I just took the biggest drink of coffee, but I think you already knew that.
Well, that's great. Well, I'm here just to talk about, you know, how great our Patreon is.
What's so great about it?
Well, we talk about a host of things, whether it be comics, movies, people we don't like, people we love, animals that we're obsessed with, favorite colors, sometimes.
Pretty recently, we did the Star Trek Christmas special, which was fun because it turns out there's no Christmas in Star Trek, but there is a Christmas Carol. So that was fun.
That was pretty fun, but I think it was kind of a psyop.
Most of our Patreon specials are maybe psyops. We have the X-Men specials that I've been doing with Priya, and yeah, there's endless, honestly, just endless, so many others, 1 billion different things that you could listen to on our Patreon. And if you want to go there today, then you could go to patreon.com/queerspec, and there are many different tiers to sign up for. However, if you sign up for any tier, you get everything, because we're commies.
Communism is good, kids. Always remember.
Tune in for our next Patreon special, the commie special. So Cecil Castellucci on here not too long ago. I think it was in March, maybe. Listeners, go looking through the archive. You'll find it. But whenever we were talking to Cecil, it was basically just like, you have to ask Heather about 90s music. And I was like, okay, because this is not just a frivolous, let's talk about something, go on a tangent and never come back again. This actually ties into your work pretty strongly, I think, because not just Nikki Fix, but I think with EEP, music is an incredibly important part of every single one of these podcasts that I have listened to. And so I would just love to talk about that, because obviously it does make sense that you're going to want to have really good music for a podcast. But I think a lot of times people will just kind of lean into like stock music or something like that, which is no shame at all, right? But then you can always tell whenever something's been kind of specifically chosen or specifically designed for a certain project, I think, too. And it can really heighten things. So I wanted to talk about that. I don't even have to ask how intentional it is, right? But like, I wanted to ask kind of, what is your thought process around music? Why is it so important to these shows? And what do you want to do with it? Like, what are you hoping to achieve with it?
Oh my goodness. What a question. And thank you so much for noticing, because there, you know, when you're creating and producing, the amount of detail work that goes into especially the music on our podcast that's one of the areas. Like, there are certain areas where, because there's so many projects, you know, I take more of an executive producer role, you know, high level, making sure the story is great and working with the creative teams as much as is humanly possible to juggle all these different projects. But the music is actually an area that I am very, very, very intimately involved with, because it's a real passion of mine. And I just think that if you're going to do a fiction podcast, which is an audio only format, that music that is integrated, the music composition, I would say, has to be, I mean, I hate to say like Sex and the City, it's like four ladies and the fifth lady is the city, you know, like with our podcast, you know, the music really is a character in each of our shows. And it is absolutely critical. It was critical to me that we figure out the budgets on our show, even though we had limited budgets, that we figure out a way to not use stock music. Because as somebody and not everybody is like listening to as many podcasts as you and me, but as somebody that listens to podcasts and fiction, like, I can tell the canned stuff from the realness. And I just felt it was so important to like bring these characters and stories to life, to have something original. So yeah, I mean, for each of our podcasts, including Nikki, and we also wrote some original music for Nikki as well, because we, you know, we did Hexel and we just loved it so much. So we just did it for Nikki as well. We had some original Nikki Fix music, which was awesome. We work with different composers on each show and just sort of crafted the sound design it's really interesting, because when you're doing audio fiction, the sound design has to not only work on its own, I think, because we use the sound design as interstitials and mood pieces, but I'm specifically also focused on using sound design as a complementary tool to the dialogue. And I use the word complementary because I think it's very easy. It's a slippery slope to create this like badass piece that, and then when you lay it over the dialogue, it drowns out the actual story, right? So that's why I say it's it's one of the characters. It needs to work in conjunction with the scene, with the story. But yeah, we've worked with different composers on our shows. Right now we're working with an amazing composer. His name is Kareem. On Bumps at Juliet, and we are going for, since that show is set in California, like a Cali sort of like chill vibes, moody situation, because it's also, there's a sports drama piece to it. So it's moody sports, Cali vibes, right? And when you're doing sound design for these shows, it's really interesting, because not only do you have to articulate the vibe, you know, like for See You in Your Nightmares, we were like isolated horror, you know, just sort of the location piece, the set piece for Seeing Your Nightmares is this center that's located on the water. So we wanted to integrate literally the sounds of water, like water elements, into the sound design for that show, eerie creaks and cranks, but then obviously there's a musicality to it. But it starts with literally the conversation that you and I are having right now. It starts with that high level. Where are we? And then what I'll do, which is one of my favorite things to do in all of these productions, is make a playlist. And that's probably what Cecil was talking about, is like, because we also, for Nikki, it was really funny because we each made our own, because music was such a big part of that one as well, made our own playlists, and her playlist and my playlist, it was like we were living different versions of the 90s. It was really, really funny because mine was like Britney Spears, because we're a little bit, there's a little bit of an age difference there, pretty whatever, Britney and like, you know, Brandy and Monica and all that, you know, and she had a little bit more of a punk pop vibe to her stuff, which is great. Like we all sort of like pulled it all together and did different vibes. But yeah, we start with a playlist and yeah, we just work with our composer. But I do think it's an absolutely critical component. You're in audio. Audio is a big part of it. And creatively, like, it's got to be on point to drive home the sort of vibe of the show and to really immerse people in the story. I mean, I cannot overstate how much time is spent on each of our shows on making the sort of composition work within the realm of the show. I could talk about that forever, so feel free to stop me. Yeah.
That's kind of it, though. I was thinking about it a little bit. And it's like, for our Decoded Horror channel, we use some stuff that is, you know, is just public domain, free for anybody to use. But it's like the moments that we choose to use, that is what matters, I think, because it's like, I think we have like two or three different people who have contributed music to that podcast. And it's always a matter of like, do any of these three composers' vibes match this scene? And or is it like a jokey commercial kind of moment that needs just kind of like a da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, kind of like goofy? And then if you choose, like, if you're intentional and you pick and choose where you're going to kind of put those, I think that that's, to me, it's like in almost all walks of life, it's the hybrid, right? Like, you know, I have like a digital camera and I put vintage lenses on it. Like, there's always something that you have to do that's kind of hybrid, like a little bit where it's like, I want analog, like I turn my autofocus off, like all of that. Like, there's a lot of things about modern cameras that I don't necessarily want, but I do want the ease of use, right? So
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
you almost have to always, but I want the vintage look, right? So you always have these kind of struggles where you sort of have to take the time to make this hybrid that's very uniquely yours. But I think that when you take that time, you're all the better for it. Like, it's noticeable, even if people can't pinpoint exactly what is noticeable about it. I think that it's something that really does completely change the vibe. If it's not there, or if that intentionality isn't there, I think that that's like a huge problem.
Oh, absolutely. Anybody that's, especially in horror fans, are some of my favorite fans, because the detail work they will notice. It's like,
oh yeah.
Yes. Everything that you said. And I just think that the masters of horror, you know, whether it's audio radio plays or whether it's, you know, like John Carpenter, you know, like that kind of, like, they understand how important, I mean, even Jaws, right? Like, a very easy argument could be made that the actual soundtrack to that movie, there is no, the shark broke down. I mean, that's the legendary like story, right, about that movie, is the shark literally wasn't working. So they had this like sound, they had this like little composition that was the shark. The shark is only on screen for like 3 seconds of the movie. Mostly right. The movie is just that sound. And it's the same thing with, yes, no, Friday the 13th, I think, there's the on-screen time is like literally one minute, and all you get is like for the whole movie.
Oh,
and that's all you needed,
right? Yeah, because it's like, yeah, there's like this, the like layered screaming in the background, but it blends with the wind in Nope that makes you just be like, what's going on? And then you see like the characters looking around and you're like, ah, like this is so much for me. So yeah, please. Sorry. I was just like, oh, right. And like other times,
like, no, really. I mean, that. Yeah, no, it's if you look back, it's, I mean, some of the most legendary, I think,
Suspiria, you know, right?
Yeah. Like, oh yeah, you look back in the, and the sort of music, I call it, it's their musical signature, you know, Jaws or Friday the 13th, or, you know, whatever, however you want to slice it and dice it. I mean, it is a critical component of those characters, because a big part of horror is, if you show the villain you know, aliens. I mean, I don't know, I could go on. You know, if you show the villain the entire movie, it's like, womp, womp, you know, like it just sort of like loses its momentum. And so, yeah, I think horror in particular, you really, and it could just be 3 seconds of an original clip. Like that's what I would actually say to if anybody's listening to this podcast that's thinking about doing, like jumping into audio fiction, I would say, you know, it doesn't need to be a John Williams level score of like 20 minutes of a full orchestra. It's the simplest things. And I think Jaws is a great example of that. It's something that's just, it could be a singular instrument or a little bit of a mix between some weird dialogue and wind and water or you know, for Lethal Lit, you know, the town was this like beat up town. And so we used the sound of like rusted metal, the creaking of rust was one of the sounds that we integrated into the Lethal Lit composition. And I just think, get creative, get weird with it, because the littlest things can be the scariest things. So especially for horror, for that genre in particular, take the time to come up with an audio signature, especially for your villain. You love to have a hero signature as well, you know, but obviously, you know, needing a villain signature, I think is critical, whether it's visual or audio.
Yeah. Like, have you learned nothing from Disney movies, right? Like, it's like the villain always has these like absolute bangers, like every time. And you're just like, oh no.
Oh my God.
It happens all the time. Like, I was even just while we were talking, like, I was thinking about all the Hitchcock movies and like those incredible soundtracks. And then you have like, yeah, it's just endless. Like, I was thinking about Eyes Without a Face and how like that movie really only has like that one, two maybe super recognizable songs. But it's like every time you hear this, like you see this woman, she's driving at night, there's a body in her trunk, and it's just like this jarring, like kind of carnival sounding music that's like playing the whole time. And it's just like, that's what makes it's like the body in the trunk is scary, right? But like that could have been diffused because it's mostly she's taking this body, she's dumping the body, but then she's just driving away like nothing ever happened. So this like kind of jarring, discordant music over that, where she's acting like she's doing a totally normal thing. We don't see the body at first, right? And like, that's just, it's, yes. Now we have come up with the fifth podcast that we would like to come back for. Yeah. So having a great time talking to you. So,
you too. This is so very fun. Very fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I always, it's just like, give me 5 things that we mutually love and it's over, you know, like this will just go for hours. But I wanted to talk about one thing that we do mutually love before we, you know, kind of wrap things up. I know that we're getting past time, but if you have a moment, I would love to talk to you about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, because you brought
that's
this
just
up.
That's just another whole podcast, but yes.
I know. I was going to say very specifically, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is a franchise that just goes in all directions, right? Correct. And so I was curious when you mentioned that, it was alongside other things like we talked a lot about, you know, the Batgirl stories from back in the day where it's like we didn't get enough. But, you know, you and I roughly same age. And so definitely knew Oracle, right, growing up. So Oracle to me is like untouchable. That whole era of Barbara Gordon is absolutely incredible. There's moments that aren't that great, I guess, but overall, like that is a great character. And that was like the best idea of where to go with that character, not to be like, you know, like now Batgirls is going and like there's a few other things. She's doing really interesting stuff now. But I think that Oracle was really kind of the thing that made her for me. And then I was thinking how Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is like such a thing where you were talking a lot about you can place them anywhere. And I was just talking to Jamie Rotonte from the Archie Comics line. And what she was talking about was Archie and how like you can drop Archie in the horror universe, you can drop Archie in superhero world, and like no matter where you put Archie, those characters are all going to click and work and it's just going to be magic every single time. Not, you know, varying degrees, but like it's definitely something where it's like those archetypes are just so iconic, right? And so I was thinking about how Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles kind of applies to that, because they are, you know, such an independent project that it starts as a comic book that's just kind of like a lot of people that like will call it like a ripoff of Daredevil, which I actually think is like one of the most dismissive things that you could possibly say. It's like a one-page throwaway moment in that original comic. Like, get over yourselves, right? Like, it's like people just have to have like a gotcha on like everything, right? But I was thinking that original story, you know, it's this like very kind of like zine style, like kind of like, you know, friends making a sort of, you know, like flaws and all, right? There's like all kinds of flaws, even through the entire Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. You talk about like a franchise that has baggage. It definitely has baggage, right? Yes. But you also have these characters that they just like, it's so strong because they just have these kind of basic archetypes that we've gotten to know them as more complicated as time has gone on, because a lot of characters have explored them more. And I was just, I don't know, I was just thinking about that. And I was like, yeah, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that makes sense with EEP. Like, I was just kind of like noticing all of these parallels between them. And see, because it's like, I would have been like, yes, of course you love Batgirl, right? Like, I would have listened to like Lethal Lit and been like, absolutely, right? Like, teen girl detectives, absolutely, this all makes sense. And then Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and actually the Scream franchise too, those were both ones where I was like, I wouldn't necessarily have been like, yes, absolutely, like immediately, like I might not have guessed that, but they're ones that kind of are adding this like extra context for me. So I was just curious, do you think that, obviously, like I said, you list it as like one of your big inspirations, like right here on the EEP site. So I was curious how did it inform EEP, I guess, to love Ninja Turtles?
Well, to try to keep it under an hour, I would say this. I mean, similar to what we talked about a little bit earlier with the way Batman or even Batgirl, to a certain extent, there's like a stretchiness. Ninja Turtles, one of the reasons why it's my favorite franchise, not only I obviously naturally was interested in it growing up.
Timing-wise, right? Because timing was everywhere.
And then I think importantly, I could spend 7,000 hours talking about Ninja Turtles, but importantly, I was interested in Ninja Turtles during a period of time where girls were still supposed to be interested in Barbie. Like we can just use Barbie as an example. But I didn't want Barbie. I wanted the Ninja Turtles pizza wagon that shot slices of pizza out of the wagon. And yes. I had Raphael come to my birthday party. I was always a Raphael. Like, I felt like I was somebody that was like a little bit, sassy, you know. But at the end of the day, again, problematic, right? There's no girl turtle. So I'm Raphael. I'm not like whichever awesome, badass, sassy lady character, right? So in terms of jumping off of the types, when I say, oh, the types of characters and stories that I wish I had seen growing up, it's like Ninja Turtles is such a great example of a totally ridiculous, like that's one of the other things I love about it, which I think you can see as a through line throughout the EEP IP, is that we love amazing stories, we love amazing characters, but also I'm not a person that generally likes to take myself so seriously. And that is Ninja Turtles, right? There is a wink and a nod to Ninja Turtles, to Scream, Lethal Lit, even Nikki or you know, Hexel, where I say, oh my God, this log line is so ridiculous, but we had to do it. That's the Ninja Turtles of it all, where it's just having the confidence of not being afraid of your most ridiculous ideas, I would say is one of my favorite aspects of Ninja Turtles. And then also taking those ridiculous ideas and saying, well, it's not like a group of dudes and then the girl is the like straight person, like April O'Neil is like, oh, but the turtles, you know, or whatever. I don't love April O'Neil. I mean, we don't all love a yellow jumpsuit, but you know, I just think that there's that, and you'll see with the EPIPs, it's a team. And I think one of the reasons, also circling back to Archie, you know, one of the reasons why Archie can work and be stretchy, similar to Batman or Ninja Turtles, is that it plays off these archetypes. And once you put different coats of paints on these archetypes that are very consistent, no matter what time period you're in, you know, once you realize that you're it's like a jump off. I think really Archie sort of figured itself out once they started doing horror, you know, Archie zombies and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I just think Ninja Turtles is just such a wonderful example of a piece of IP that, and the same thing, can be aged up, right? Because to me, the live action, especially the first live action Ninja Turtles movie, a live action, I call it live action. I mean, they were in puppet costumes or whatever, but I call it live action. The first, there's a darkness. There's an absolute darkness to that. And they lightened it up a little bit with Secret of the Ooze, and they brought in Vanilla Ice, and things might have gotten a little bit out of control. But still, that ninja song in Secret of the Ooze is like iconic anyway. You know, so, and again, we could have a whole separate thing about that. But, you know, there's a darkness. they turned on the darkness, which was more, to your point, indicative of the original comic, right? There's a darkness to it. They lightened it up for the animated show. Mm-hmm. They went and darkened it again for the movie. Then they lightened it up again. I just think it's this great example of something that's so ridiculous that can also be stretchy. And that's one of the reasons why, as somebody that creates IP today, why I still like love it and look back on it for, you know, sort of inspiration. And I look for elements. And I think, like I said, like the team dynamic between those characters ultimately combined with the ridiculousness of the concept and the wink of it is really the magic of Ninja Turtles. And hopefully, you know, we've had some success here at EEP. We haven't had yet. To be cut to coming soon, hopefully. Ninja Turtles level success. But, you know, that's the goal, right? Is to create something that has that stickiness. Because ultimately, I mean, to me, the most dynamic parts of Ninja Turtles is the relationship between Leonardo and Raphael and the conflict there, you know? And so that's kind of complex for something that's technically aimed towards younger kids. And so that's a lot of what we try to do with EEP, even with our younger projects like Absolute Zeroes, or even the Curious Society, which are a little bit younger facing, the complex relationships between groups of women or mixed gender groups, right? It's not just all dudes, you know, it's like, especially nowadays, I think that there's less of like, these toys are for boys and these toys are for girls. It's like, everything is a little bit mixed and match, which is awesome. So then let's have characters and stories reflect the ability to mix and match those types of characters together. And that's what we do. I love, you know, Lethal It. It's like Tig is the main detective. But, you know, Win and Max are right there with her. You know, it's like I like to say, it's like our Scooby gang. You know, you got to have a team because everybody's bringing something to the table. So I just love telling stories with like teams and just the sort of like interplay of different characterization. But again, just also not taking ourselves so seriously because ultimately we're just making stuff that's supposed to provide an escape for people. And, you know, there should be an underlying message of either, you know, it's like, femininity or commentary on femininity or LGBTQ issues or whatever is a sort of commentary on media. Like I love for our IPs to have some sort of underpinning to them that it's not just this thing exploded because that feels a little like empty to me. But yeah, just like, again, I could go on and on and on about the Ninja, about Ninja Turtles, but let me know. Yeah.
Well, I think I'll say that the last 5 years, they have had Rise of the Ninja Turtles, and then they had the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles comics by Sophie Campbell. And I think that really proves your point because the Sophie Campbell comics are very nuanced and like just kind of fascinating and kind of work as how do the Ninja Turtles interact with this larger city, right? And like, you know, Splinter was deceased. I don't know if that's still true, but in the beginning of the run, Splinter had died and like the brothers had been torn apart by it, right? And to me, that's just like, it's complicated, you know, it's like there's this level of, you know, complexity that you didn't expect from the Ninja Turtles, even as somebody who's been reading them for so long. But then you also have something where Rise of the Ninja Turtles is like one of the most high quality Ninja Turtles projects ever. It's explicitly designed for young kids, I think, like from what I can tell. And they had a comics version of it that was one of my favorite comics. Like it was just absolutely incredible. Again, totally aimed for children, you know, and that means nothing because we all read at all ages at this point. But it's just kind of an interesting thing to me because it's like, as you're saying, it's like, they can really go in any direction. So I do appreciate that, you know, you took the time to talk to me about all of this stuff because I'm absolutely fascinated. I think that EEP is doing a lot of incredibly interesting stuff. You're working with great creators, people who we've had on the pod, you know, people who we like, we're always following their work regardless. So it's kind of just interesting, you know, just to hear kind of, I guess, like the behind the scenes from it. This is definitely a podcast that could easily go on 5 to 6 hours without, I think, either of us getting tired from what I can tell because we're both Raphaels, right? So I think that this might be a good place to call it. But I was going to say, you know, I just appreciate having you on. This has been a really fun conversation. And yeah, thanks for being here.
Awesome. No, thanks for having me. This was great. Super fun. I mean, yeah, I just what can I say? Like, I got into this because I love like the history of IP and creating new IP. So this is a great forum for me. I could talk about it forever. But yeah, thanks for having me. And yeah, hopefully we'll do it again at some point.
Yeah, I would love that. So I wanted to ask you to share with our listeners where they can find your work, where they can find EEP, how they can support, you know, all of the things.
So yeah, it's eepuniverse.com. If you head there, you'll be able to click through all the different IPs that we talked about on today's show. We're at eepuniverse on all of the socials, on TikTok and Instagram and YouTube and all the places. So yeah, just go there and find whichever, you know, it's like Baskin Robbins, find which flavor you want to check out first. You know, you want a murder mystery. All of our podcasts actually are available on every major podcast platform, Spotify, iHeart, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to podcasts, all of our podcasts are available. So check out Lethal Lit, See You in Your Nightmares, Daughters of DC, Nikki Fix, and coming soon, Bump Set Juliet. Curious Society is out. Please check it out. We consulted with 20 different female scientists to create the characters in that, to make it authentic to the experience that these women went through coming up through the ranks of actually being like the only woman in the room in all these ridiculously awesome scientific fields like robotics and just cool stuff, cool people, cool stuff. So check out the Curious Society Volume 2 coming soon, and Absolute Zeros is coming out in the spring as well. So lots of fun stuff, on the horizon.
Yeah, I was going to say that we did kind of stick to like an overview for the most part, but each of these projects could easily be its own interview. So definitely everybody check out EEP and stay tuned to what's coming out, because it sounds like it's going to be a lot, actually. So I'm excited to see what comes, you know, in 2024, 2025, all the way into the future. So thanks for being here. And thanks to, of course, my co-hosts who aren't here today, S.E. Fleenor and Monica Estrella Negra. Thanks to Kate Warner, who is our sound engineer. Thanks to Katie Taylor, who did our music. And thank you to, of course, all of our listeners. If you want to support what we do, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/queerspec. And also you could go buy those Decoded anthologies I talked about, and you could follow the Decoded Horror channel. There's maybe 17 other things you could do to support us. I'm not sure. We've got a link tree, you know, like God bless link tree, because it really helps all of us who do 700 different projects. But yeah, thanks to you for being here. Follow everything, and you know, we'll see you in your nightmares, frankly. So, you know, talk to you all soon. Bye.
You're listening to Bitches on Comics, distributed by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away. Find more shows like Bitches on Comics by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm. Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @BitchesOnComics and on Instagram at @BitchesOnComics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by joining us on Patreon. Head to patreon.com/queerspec to learn more.
I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm S.E. Fleenor. You can learn more about me at sefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
I'm Monica Estrella Negra, and you can find me at www.audreysrevenge.com or on Twitter at @AudreyRevenge.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Church Fire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land, the Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.